Good afternoon, everyone. I call this meeting of the House Travel Affairs Committee to order at 3:06 p.m. Monday, March 6, 2023 in Capitol Room 106. I think some more folks are going to kind of trickle in here as we go along. I know we've got some committees that kind of run up right against the 3 o'clock mark, so we'll give them a little bit of a break here. But what members present now currently are Representative Carpenter, Representative Allard, Representative Armstrong, Representative Dybert, and myself, Chair Rep McCormick. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please, everyone, take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of this meeting. The rule that if your phone goes off, you have to buy donuts will be strictly enforced throughout this committee. And you will have to bring adequate donuts for every member in attendance. Thank you. Before we begin, I want to thank Suniva St. Clair, the House Travel Affairs Committee Secretary from Records, and Lisa Denny from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today. So we're kind of pressed for time. I know we have to be on the floor at 5, and I think there's a lot of subject matter to get through this afternoon. So I think we're going to hold back sort of the whole introduction portion of this to a later meeting so that we can get through our guests and give them adequate time to present. So today, I believe on Teams, we have a presentation from Liz LaQuenne Medicine Crow, President and CEO of First Alaskans Institute, and Barbara Wahalal Gidok Lake, Director of the Alaska Native Policy Center. Following that, we have Kim Reitmeier, President of the ANCSA Regional Association. We're grateful and honored to have also in our presence President Richard Charlie Esch Peterson from the Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribe present in the room. So I believe Ms. Medicine Crow has joined us on. Okay, she has not joined us on Teams. She had her name here. I apologize. So I know I see Ms. Blake here. So if you could come forward and start the presentation, that would be great. Just want to let the members know, again, with our time constraints, I think we're just going to go ahead. If you have questions, save them for the end. Unless you have a question that's absolutely burning and you need to ask it, we can go ahead and do it that way. So thank you very much again for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sangait La Uflong, the day is getting good. Wafal Gidak Hinudi Kiang, you did very good pronouncing my name, so thank you for that. Wafal Gidak is my name. Barbara Blake, Ya'atsatai Hinudi Kiang. Barbara Blake is my English name. I want to start by acknowledging all the leadership in the room, including my president, President Richard Chachat Ish Peterson, for being here, and hopefully the content that we provide today for First Alaskans, and again, Loganai is not feeling well today, so she wasn't able to join us, is helpful and useful. One of the reasons that we started this this presentation and this type of training many, many years ago through First Alaskans Institute is because a lot of this information is not taught in schools. There is no place to learn this information unless you seek it out, either through the university system or through an institution like First Alaskans Institute. So hopefully all of the information that we go over today will be helpful in growing and building the understanding of the complexity of the Alaska Native community and the diverse organizations, governments, and institutions that make up the Alaska Native community. So we always like to start our presentations with this quick little video, and it's kind of a fun one to kind of get a point across, but I'll play it really quickly.
Apologies, guys. Let me make sure the sound works.
Okay, we'll try this one more time.
This is an awareness test. How many passes does the team in white make? The answer is 13. But did you see the moonwalking bear?
Yeah, we like to play that short little video because it helps us to recognize that unless we're told to focus on something, we often don't see it. And the same goes with the knowledge that we hold and the knowledge that we carry when we're making decisions and we're making everyday processes and policies that impact the lives of everybody in this state. And so I'm so thankful that all of you have chosen and made the decision to be here today to listen to this short presentation on Alaska Native governance and protocols so that we can give you a little bit of snippets of a deeper understanding so that you don't have to walk through life not seeing that moonwalking bear, that you can see them in all facets of decision making, that hopefully you can see that in a lot of the information that you're carrying forward on a regular basis. So, to start the presentation, when we say 10,000 years of stewardship, that's carbon dated proof of existence for Alaska Native people here on this in this place. What we say as Alaska Native and our traditional stories go back to time immemorial. This is our origin, and our creation stories exist in this place, in the places of Alaska, in the places that we exist in today. But when we say 10,000 years of stewardship, that's 10,000 years of proven social scientists, carbon-dated proof of existence in this place. There was a remains on Prince of Wales Island found in a cave, and one of the ladies back here, Sarah Dibdahl, was instrumental in this study. But they found a human remains in one of the caves on Prince of Wales Island, and that human, that individual, one of our ancestors, they tested his DNA to DNA today. And what do you know, it matched to the Thlinkit people here who exist in this place today. So when we say 10,000 years, that's 10,000 years of proven existence in this place, tested with all of the social science DNA testing that you can go through. And I'm sure Sarah has a lot more to say on that front. But when we're talking about that existence in a place, right, we're talking about the time frame of two worldwide floods. The time frame of glaciers coming in and coming out, moving, and all of the geographic changes that we've seen in our places since this year, these thousands of years of existence in this place. And we also see the cultural distinct differences throughout Alaska. My people are as different from the Inupiaq people up north as I am to, say, the Maoris of New Zealand. We're that distinct. Our cultural groups are not the same people. We speak completely different languages. Our cultures are completely different from one another. And so when we say we're not a monolith, it's because we're not all the same people. We come from over 20 distinct cultures with varying levels of cultural norms. But some of our values are underpinning all of our cultures. And a lot of those value systems are what we like to refer to as human values. They cross not only Alaska Native cultures, but more than that into almost every single cultural group on this planet. And so when we're thinking about the value systems that we have as Native people, a lot of them are the same. But again, I want to reiterate that we are not the same people. Our distinct cultural groups are completely unique, especially because when we're talking about Alaska, right, whenever you're explaining Alaska to someone down south, it's so huge. Southeast to the Arctic is completely different of one another. And so those cultural groups developed over time from that geographic difference that we all exist from. So when we're talking about sovereignty, we're talking about the three sovereigns that exist in Alaska today. Tribes, the state, and federal government. And when we say tribes, we mean that And because now the state of Alaska is one of the entities that recognizes tribal sovereignty, is that when folks first started coming to this place we now call Alaska, there was a recognition that existing here were complex government systems that already had a level of caretaking for all the people who exist in this place. So there was a recognition by all of those folks who were coming to call Alaska home that there was already sophisticated forms of government that were already existing amongst the indigenous populations that exist here. And those today are inherent tribal sovereignty that exists among the 229 tribes that exist in our state today. It's a recognition that, yes, prior to contact, prior to outsiders first coming here, the indigenous population did, in fact, have sophisticated forms of caretaking for their people in the form of governance structures for each individual community that exists in this place. And what else do we have? We have the state government and we have federal government. And one thing that I really appreciate about our CEO and president, she always says, we can look at this as one third plus one third plus one third. Or we can look at this as one plus one plus one. Triple the amplification of our ability to care for every single citizen in this state by working together. Instead of looking at it as a deficit, and you only have one third of the pie, I have one third of the pie, and the federal government has one third of the pie, we can see this as a triple effect in the ability to care for the people of Alaska. This is what those tribes look like on a map. And so when you're looking and thinking about the distinct 229 tribes in Alaska, we're talking about almost half of the tribes in the United States of America. So we have 565, I think the number goes up and down depending on who's in administration, but 565 approximate tribes in the United States, and 229 of those exist here in Alaska. That's a huge bonus when I think about it. It's an ability for us to amplify that triple effect in a way that is above and beyond what a lot of states in the lower 48 can accomplish by having not as many tribes as we do in Alaska. And so when we're looking at all of this innovation, this ability to identify sophisticated governance structures, the caretaking at a localized level, which I know that we're all proponents of, this map of the 229 tribes is the basis for how I see that localized ability to care for communities. And so 229 tribes, what you can see here also with each individual distinct tribe is that most of these communities you cannot access by road. Most of these communities you can only access by air or by boat. And a lot of these communities are so separated from each other that you cannot access from one community to the next unless you go by air or by boat. And so what formalized over the many thousands of years of existence is each individual community creating for themselves a way of caretaking for the people that exist in that place. And so while you see there in Southeast, a lot of those tribes are all part of the Tlingit Nation, you can also see that because of their distinct geographic areas, that each of them had their own individualized form of caretaking for their community, their own set of laws, their own set of cultural values that made them distinct from the next community over, even though they both spoke the same language. And so when it came time for the federal government to decide who was a tribe and who was not, or to recognize and acknowledge, I should say, those distinct differences were important enough to the Alaska Native people that they felt a need to keep separate from one another because of the level of caretaking, the level of laws, the level of values that separated them from their neighbors to the north or to the south or to the west or to the east. So that's why we have 229.
Very quickly, sorry to interrupt. I just would like the record to reflect that at 3:19 p.m. we were joined by Representative Hanson. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry I'm going fast, but I do want to leave time for the other guest speakers. So if at any time you have questions, please feel free to interject. So when we're thinking about the value systems that govern and have always governed who we are as Indigenous people, important to know that those traditional values and knowledge and how that information was carried forward was through an orate society. So there was no written form of governance, written form of knowledge passage from one community to the next for any of our communities, but the oratory that was passed on from one generation to the next was so ingrained in who we were that you had to be able to reiterate a story to the I, you know, dotting the I and crossing the T so well that an elder would not allow you to repeat that story unless he knew that you were telling it word for word from the previous generation. And so when we see our leadership throughout Alaska, and these are our ancestors now who have gone on to fight battles and to work in for work in and for our communities, important to know that the value systems that they carry and the knowledge systems that they also carry were passed down from one generation to the next. We had a woman who spoke at our elders and youth conference this year who talked about how we hid aspects of our culture in our ways of life, in our hunting, fishing, and gathering practices. So while a lot of our traditional practices as people was outlawed, our language, our songs, our dance, our ceremonial wear, our native vests were outlawed from being worn in this state, there was a way for us to continue to carry forward our culture and I love that she said that we hid it in aspects of our culture we were able to retain. And so you'll see that in a lot of the those who are advocating for our ways of life today and those who have gone on from us, who continued to advocate up until they left us for our ways of life. And this is just in recognition of those of three individuals that we like to highlight at First Alaskans for the work that they've done in and for our community. So, and here's a really awesome look at our distinct language groups in Alaska. And you'll see here that we have the different language groups that some of them do have a root dialect that maybe can be and oftentimes can be understood from an Aleutic person to, you know, a Central Yupik person. And we actually should change this because this verbiage is not appropriate and not one that the folks have identified as one. We'll fix it for you folks and send you over the correct version. But that the Athabascan language, as for an example, Atna folks and Gwich'in folks can probably understand some words, but their languages are so unique and have adapted so much over time that their languages are not completely the same. And just as an example, for Atna, you say Chinan for thank you. And in Gwich'in, you say Basay, right? That's just how you say thank you in their distinct languages. Some words are the same, but oftentimes the language has adapted so much that they're hard to compare apples for apples, these distinct linguistic groups in Alaska. So when we say 20 plus distinct cultural groups, we mean just that. So even though the social scientists of the world have grouped us by what they call similar language styles, similar cultural norms and practices, similar cultural makeup, that we see ourselves as 20 distinct cultural groups. And this percentage has actually changed as well. As of the last census, we are 22% of the state. So here's just a look at those language maps. And I really like to point out that you can see the Diné language base, that bright red on the big map of North America over to the right. You can see the Diné language base that is all of the what we refer to as the interior of Alaska, go all the way through Canada and then drop down into some of the states down south. So into California, into New Mexico and Nevada. And fun little tidbit, when we're talking about distinct language groups, the language base for the Navajo Nation, for the Apache Nation, is similar to that of our Athabascan languages. But again, so unique unto themselves that they are distinct of each other. But some words those individuals can pick up from one culture to the other. So be fun little. I'd love to be in the room when a Navajo and a Gwich'in are having a conversation with one another. Okay. And also an important little fact, I want folks to recognize here that while these arbitrary borders that were kind of like slammed on top of our cultural groups, while the United States and oftentimes will recognize that, you know, that's Canada, that's Alaska or the United States, those are the same people in our eyes. So if you drop down to where the Haida people are in southern southeast, you'll see that half of my family live in Haida Gwaii, what is, you know, an arbitrary line into Canada, but half of them live on Prince of Wales Island. And so it's an arbitrary line that was just laid upon us. We don't recognize that line as something that divides our community. We've always understood that our community is across the border, irregardless of the line that was drawn on top of us. So important to note that factor, because so many nations throughout Alaska were just cut in half by the line in between Canada and the United States. And I also want to say that if you can prove that you have roots in Canada, like I can in Haida Gwaii, that we have full hunting and fishing rights over there. So that's a fun little tidbit. So when we're talking about political and racial status, it's important to understand those two distinctions, because oftentimes what likes to be challenged for our Alaska Native tribal entities is the racial status, when in reality, it's actually the political status that a lot of tribes and the federal government make decisions based on our political status as Native entities. When I was talking about our inherent rights, our inherent government that existed prior to folks coming here, that is a recognized political status by the federal government today. We also have protections. I, as a tribal citizen, have rights in a political status form as a delegate of Tlingit and Haida, but I also have a racial protection, right? A racial class that is protected under civil rights of the United States of America. And so it's really important that to understand that distinction, because oftentimes you could be challenging or speaking to something that is race-based when actuality it is something that is tied to our inherent rights as a sovereign nation, as our tribes in the United States, and it actually falls under that political category. And so it's really important to know which one you're talking about when you're challenging whether or not a tribe has the right under the Constitution of Alaska to be able to favor tribal citizens. It's because of the political status and not because of the race status. Nothing to do with the color of my skin, but everything to do with the fact that I am a tribal citizen to the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. So really important distinction to know and to understand when you're looking and thinking about law and policy. So there's the three C's of tribal sovereignty in areas where government institutions can come into relationship and partnership with. One of them you'll hear a lot is, right, consultation. And that's, I'm going to check with you about, you know, putting in this road through your backyard before I actually start construction on putting a road in your backyard. That's consultation, making sure that we're having the ability to have a conversation with one another, recognizing that you are a sovereign, I am a sovereign, and we have that important relationship with one another to check and make sure that what we're moving forward is in alignment with both of us. So as another, for instance, the federal government oftentimes will change things and enact a law that is going to impact Alaskans. What do we always ask of the federal government, right? We ask them to have a conversation with the state of Alaska before they make that decision. The same thing goes with our tribal governments. What they're asking for is for a conversation before a decision is made that's going to impact our tribes. Compacting and contracting are really important to understand the difference, especially as the state of Alaska is growing in its capacity to compact with our tribes. With compacting, it's important to recognize that, and this is just my basic way of describing it, I'm acknowledging you as a sovereign, you're acknowledging me as a sovereign. We understand that our mutual goal is the same, but how you as a tribe get to that goal is up to you, because I recognize that you know best how to care for your people, and you're going to make decisions best on how to care for that community in a way that I may not understand, maybe from the state of Alaska perspective, because I don't live in your community. You've been there the whole time. You've been there since time immemorial, and you have a better understanding of how to care for them. That is compacting. really important to draw the distinction between compacting and contracting, because contracting is you and I are entering into an agreement. Whether or not I recognize your tribal sovereignty is completely, you know, it can be out the window or it can be on the table. But we have an end goal that we both want to achieve. But I, as the state of Alaska, want you to achieve it A, B, C, you know, D, E, F. However, we decide, you know, as the state of Alaska, that we want you to accomplish this end goal, we're putting into the contract. So it's less of an ability for an entity like a tribal entity to be able to go out and develop a program as best as they see fit. So important to understand those two distinctions, because I've heard the term a lot in these halls, you know, compacting this, compacting that, when in reality, the end result is actually just contracting and not actually a true compacting of services. Okay. So we have a lot of different organizations in Alaska. Log and I, our CEO, likes to say we were hashtag it's complicated before Facebook made it a thing. 229 tribal governments, right? You saw the slide with all of the distinct tribal governments, 12 INCSA regional corporations, and about 195, I think it's actually closer to 180 now, INCSA village corporations, 12 regional nonprofits, and then so on and so forth. So it's important to understand the distinction between a tribe and a corporation. Our tribal governments are again, that inherent authority, that inherent sovereignty that existed amongst our people and continues to exist today. That's the inherent sovereignty. It's an acknowledgement by the federal government and now an acknowledgement by the state of Alaska that, yes, tribes existed. Yes, the indigenous people had a sophisticated form of governing prior to anybody else coming here that everybody acknowledges today. And important to understand that that's a distinct category from our INCSA, Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, regional and village corporations. Our INCSA regional corporations exist. I think there's a slide I'll show you in a second with the distinct boundaries of our INCSA regional corporations. Our INCSA regional corporations and the village corporations were a result of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act in 1970. And that was the state of Alaska, the federal government, and our indigenous people halting what was to be the state of Alaska's right to select land when they became a state, and then enacting that right to select land. Our indigenous population and the leadership of our indigenous people said, well, we have to pause for a minute and have this conversation because this land actually belongs to the native people here. And so we need to have a conversation before any land is selected by the state of Alaska. And as a result, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act created, actually at the time, 13 regional corporations and 203 village corporations. The regional corporations, aside from the 13th regional corporation, and I'll talk about that in a minute, had surface and subsurface rights to the land in their region. All of that land designation was based upon the individual regional corporation and village corporation for what that would look like and how that would be dispersed. And I will say that while a lot of folks like to think that this has all been settled, you know, all of the native corporations have all the land that they originally selected almost over 50 years ago now. And in reality, a lot of these corporations are still waiting on parcels to be handed over either from the federal or the state government that from their original selection back in the 1970s. Our village corporations we're as you can see, the number for our tribal governments and our village corporations almost match. We're they only own the surface land. So village corporations, regional corporations, both got their authority and continue their authority under state jurisdiction. So each of these corporations has to get a business license from the state of Alaska. So that means that the laws pertaining to how they operate are in accordance with state business law. So when we're talking about tribal government to corporation, important to draw those distinct lines of differences as where they draw their line of authority and where that comes from. The 13th Regional Corporation, just for a little tidbit, was created for those who existed outside of Alaska at the time INCSA was signed. Later, INGSA was amended, so most of those individuals have now folded in either into their regional corporations, into their village corporations, and so the 13th regional corporation, I believe, is dissolved now, because almost every single one of those individuals ended up being able to go back to their home territory and enroll in their regional and village corporations. And so they are the for-profit arm. They receive the land settlement from the federal government. They receive the land. They retain the land. One little fun thing that was created in Congress that is unlike any other corporate structure I've ever seen in the world is that what you've probably heard is 7i revenue sharing. And if you haven't heard of this, 70% of the profits for INGSA regional corporations that are made from natural resource profit making is then divvied up among all the other regional corporations, and it's called 7i revenue sharing. And then 7j payments are then from the regional corporation down to the village corporations within that region. And so those are on natural resources that are shared amongst all other native entities. So ASRC, as for an example, could be making money up north on oil extraction. 70% of their revenue on oil extraction is then divided among all 12 regional corporations. For Sea Alaska down here in Southeast, we made money for many years on timber. 70% of our timber revenue was then distributed among all 12 regional corporations. And I say 12 because we also gave ourselves one of those 70% of that share of those shares of that revenue. And I say it's unlike any other. Can you imagine if Target had to share their revenue sources with Walmart? Or if something else like that took place. It was very interesting and something that has long been a way for our communities and our corporations to come together in many instances to advocate for like-minded policy and governance. Okay, the 12 regional corporations. That is our Tanana Chiefs Conference. That is our Alaska Village Corporation, Alaska Village Council Presidents. That is our Kuwerks of Alaska. And those entities gain their line of authority from the tribal governments that exist in those places, with the exception of Tlingit and Haida. And I'll let President Peterson speak to that with his time. But the 12 regional nonprofits have the ability to negotiate for federal funding that comes in as a result of tribes existing in this place, i.e., one of the examples is Indian healthcare funding. Those regional nonprofits, like TCC, have the ability to go into those negotiations because the tribes in that area give them the authority. They say, here's our annual designation to allow TCC to go in and negotiate on our behalf as a tribe. And part of that is because, as you saw from that map, that's 229 tribes in Alaska. Some of those tribes are quite small. And so when you would negotiate for a tribe, say, of 60 people, you probably wouldn't get as much money if you pulled all of your resources into one entity like TCC or like Kuwerk, and give them the authority and ability to negotiate on your behalf. And so those entities help to govern and help to negotiate and help to administer dollars on behalf of the communities that exist. And I'll say that most of those regional nonprofits are made up, their decision-making body is made up of the tribes that exist within their regions. I think the rest of this is pretty self-explanatory. I won't go into that too much, with the caveat that it's important to recognize that Metlakatla is our one Indian reservation in Alaska that is that exists outside of the INGSA settlement. So they are not part of INGSA, but they are a part of our Alaska Native tribal system. So here's just a quick look at how those distinct corporations are made up and the corporation boundaries in Alaska. They almost fall within the linguistic groups, as you can see, with a few caveats and a few differences amongst them. Okay, I went over that one already. So when we're thinking about the different layers of governance in Alaska, it's important to understand that each of our tribes in Alaska is autonomous to itself. They're independent, and they do have an interdependence when you're thinking about the TCCs, the Kuregs, the ABCPs of the world. But that we all have a concurrent community of care. So even though we have distinct differences between what we are trying to accomplish, that our community of care between a regional nonprofit, a tribe, and oftentimes an INCSA corporation, they do see that we are all Alaska Native peoples. We have an Alaska Native cultural root that connects all of us, and that all of us in our capacities have to act in multiple spaces in order to ensure that the level of community care is in existence across these multiple governments, these multiple entities, I should say. And so what does that mean for municipal governments? That means that me, as an Alaska Native person, I sit here as a citizen of the state of Alaska. I'm also a citizen of Juneau. I'm also a citizen of Tlingit and Haida. I'm also a shareholder of Sea Alaska Corporation. I'm a Tlingit and Haida delegate. I sit on city council. I sit on our Sea Alaska board of directors. That my level of care for our community and for our people exists in all of those spaces. And so when we say that outwardly our ability and connections between all of these entities is a level of care, it's again referring to that amplifier effect. What can we do in these collective spaces in an amplification of all of these different entities to amplify our community care for each community that exists in Alaska? Okay. Oftentimes, so I'm sure you've heard this before, and you'll probably hear it again, Public Law 280 is what exists here in Alaska. There are a total of, I want to say, 8 states that have that fall under Public Law 280. And what that means is that the state of Alaska and the tribes that exist have concurrent jurisdiction over some aspects of criminal and then civil jurisdiction over tribal members. So that means that I, as a tribal citizen, because again, remember, we only have one reservation in Alaska, I, as a tribal citizen, fall under the laws of the state of Alaska, but I also fall under the laws of Tlingit and Haida. So the laws that govern who I am and how I operate in accordance with the laws are bound by both of those two entities. And so it's a concurrent jurisdiction, between those two entities. And again, sorry, this is actually outdated because the second bullet there has been alleviated a lot by the tribal recognition that took place last year. But to say that a lot of the dollars that come into the state of Alaska are granted to the state of Alaska on behalf of the Native people that exist here, and that is because of Public Law 280. So a lot of the education dollars that come into the state of Alaska, a lot of the public safety dollars that come into the state of Alaska, and many other dollars like transportation and so on and so forth, that the state of Alaska receives are on behalf of the Native people that exist in this place. And that is a direct result of Public Law 280. And so that means that the state of Alaska has a responsibility in those instances to uphold its level of care for the indigenous population of this state as a result of Public Law 280. The drilling down of all of those dollar sources is very comprehensive, and I would love for someone to do a master's thesis on just that. But just to keep in mind as we're thinking about the level of care and the level of changes to law, changes to policy that each of us are responsible for, that Public Law 280 is in place so that there is a concurrent level of care, but one that is an acknowledgement that the indigenous population, the sovereignty and tribals that exist here, give the state of Alaska quite a bit of service dollars in order to care for every citizen in Alaska. And I will say that a lot of those dollars are often used not just towards our tribal citizens in this state, but also used for everyday citizens. So when we're talking about law enforcement dollars in particular, those dollars are to care for all the citizens of Alaska most often. It's not a separate program that is just geared for Alaska Native people, in other words. and speaking of law enforcement. A lot of times this comes up, so we decided to keep it in here. Important to understand the distinction between the Alaska State Troopers. The VPSOs are also a state function. VPOs and TPOs are not a state function. That is a set aside, and it is a pilot program that Lisa Murkowski has set up actually quite a few years ago now. And that is working directly with law enforcement dollars that go directly to tribes to set up their own police public safety systems in those communities. And so it's ongoing and will continue to be ongoing to kind of gauge the level of ability for those dollars to stretch a little further. We know that there's a lot of remote communities in Alaska, and we know that oftentimes our state troopers and our public safety officers often cannot get to those communities. So one way we've been talking with our congressional delegation to try and remedy some of that situation is through the VPO and TPO program. So next is just a quick section on our ways of life. When we say our ways of life, as Native people, we're talking about our hunting, fishing, and gathering practices. And so we're not talking about just the ability to go out and catch a fish and put it on the table for sustenance for my family. When we speak about our ways of life, and this is a beautiful quote by one of our individuals who spoke at a recent Protecting Our Ways of Life summit, it's about a holistic care of our communities and of our peoples. And just to give you a good idea of what this means, when my son was 12, he went out with some family or with some friends actually in Kluwak, and he came back with a subsistence harvest that was enough to care for every single person, almost every single person in our family. And one of our elders said, it's time for his manhood ceremony. And at the time, at 12 years old, I had been a single mom his entire life. And I don't mean a single mom as in I was sharing custody with someone. I mean, there was an absent parent in this picture. So having to figure out how to raise a young boy all by myself as a woman became a very big challenge. But because that day an elder told us it was time for his manhood ceremony, he all of a sudden had a different recognition of who he was expected to be. And the recognition of his manhood wasn't that he caught a fish. It was that he could care for his community with the fish that he was able to catch. And his responsibility became a responsibility to our community. And so she took us she walked us through the ceremony. And in that ceremony, he gifted again every single person who participated. And as they were sitting there, they all gifted him in return. And about 10 people stood up and made public declarations to help guide him into manhood, something that I could never do as a woman, and something that I could never do to help him understand the role of a man in our community. But our people that day made sure that our ways of life were wrapping around him holistically to ensure that he would know what his responsibility was. And I think about that in terms of what it means for so many of our relatives who live on the Yukon who haven't had that in the last 3 years. And so when we're talking about our ways of life, we're talking about something so significant to our spirituality, our culture, our people, the future of how we care for every person in our community. And when that goes away, so does so much of how we care for our people. And I like to use my son as that example because he's 16 now, and every single one of those people who made that promise on that day have been there, taking him out, showing him what his responsibility is as a man in our society and as a man in our community. And I can't imagine what our young men are trying to grapple with without something like that to show them and to guide them and to help them be those men in our community. So on that note, we have some ideas here that we've just thrown as what can exist. I'm sure you've heard the co-management idea, the co-stewardship, taking the ability of our triple effect of care for our peoples and care for our communities. But instead of seeing each and every one of us as and our tribes to the state of Alaska as enemies, what can we do and what can we accomplish when all of us are sitting down at the table and figuring out what that amplifier effect is? What is that amplifier effect for the voices that exist in every single one of those spaces? How can we use those voices to help us better improve policy, better have a good understanding of what's happening on the ground, and to have those conversations when we're making decisions that are going to impact everyday Alaskans. That's it. That's my presentation. And happy to answer questions.
First of all, I just wanted to thank you very much for that presentation. So I said that we would keep questions to the end. Does anyone have any questions for Ms. Blake regarding her presentation? None. Wow, you guys are just sponges. Thank you very much for doing that as quickly as you did. We all really appreciate that as we're kind of pressed for time. Let's see here. Would just like to quickly note that we were joined at 3:33 by Representative Hemshute. Representative Hemshute, welcome to our committee. Thank you again, Ms. Blake, for your presentation. I will now introduce our next presenter, Kim Reitmeier, President of ANGSA Regional Association. Ms. Reitmeier, would you please put yourself on the record? And I understand you're online. So we just kind of get like a confirmation that you're on.
Wonderful. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. You're coming through loud and clear. Feel free to start.
Fantastic. Thank you, Chair McCormick. My name is Kim Reitmeier. I am the president of the ANGSA Regional Association. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here today. It truly is an honor to share the room with the leadership at the table and also acknowledge leadership in the room with Barbara Blake and President Peterson. So thank you so much for allowing us an opportunity to share a little bit of our lens of the constellation that represents our Alaska Native people. Again, my name is Kim Reitmeier. I am Stupyok. My family's from Kodiak. I am a shareholder of Kodiak. I'm also a shareholder of Yuzinki Native Corporation, and I'm the tribal citizen of Shunaf Tribe of Kodiak. And I believe, Callan, are you driving my presentation today? Wonderful. Thanks so much. And my apologies for not being there today. I was there last week during the Snowmageddon on Wednesday, and so I'm back in Anchorage today. So just real briefly, the next slide, I think if you're on, I can't see the screen. It's pretty bright. So, Callan, if you just wouldn't mind, the second slide is just the organization that I represent is the ANGSA Regional Association. And we came together in the late 90s. If any of you have had the opportunity to meet Karl Marz, he was then president of CERI. And he and some Alaska Native leaders came together to create the ANGSA Regional Corporation, and that represents the 12 Alaska Native Regional Corporations that were created under ANGSA. We're very fortunate in our state to have many organizations that represent, especially the Alaska Federation of Natives, that represents all Alaska Native entities. But Carl and our Native leaders really felt it was vitally important to keep our regional corporations, the CEOs at the table, having conversations about how they could collaborate and serve and represent our Alaska Native people. Next slide. So the board of directors are the presidents and CEOs of each one of those organizations. The intent was to keep it at the highest level of the organization so that we could be assured that we had the presidents working collaboratively to work for the betterment of our Alaska Native people. Next slide. So Barbara gives a wonderful overview, and every time I hear her, I learn something new, because that is really how unique and complex the Alaska Native structure is in Alaska. And it really is this unique constellation that represents our Alaska Native people. So it takes the regional corporations, our village corporations, the nonprofits, the tribes, and those statewide organizations that come together to represent our Alaska Native people. As Barbara mentioned, our regional corporations and our village corporations are traditionally the landholders through ANCSA. Our regional corporations own the subsurface rights for the land, and the village corporations own the surface estate rights. Next slide. So ANCSA was a complete unique federal Indian policy that we had never seen before in the 70s. And it really took Alaska more than 104 years, to address Aboriginal land claims. And it came together in late 1971 when Richard Nixon signed into law the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Now, it's important to note, too, that not all of our Alaska Native people or regions voted to support ANCSA. We actually had some that voted against ANCSA because feeling that it was too much of a land giveaway. But after many years of collaboration and negotiations, we came together to sign ANCSA. And what ANCSA did is it provided just about 44 million acres back to Alaska Native land ownership. And that land is held in fee simple title. The act also created just under $1 billion that would be paid out because lands that could not be returned. We had townships, we had national parks, so that land that couldn't be returned to Native ownership, that money was in lieu of those lands. We also created, as Barbara mentioned, 12 regional corporations, and those boundaries were defined by heritage and common interest. And then within those 12 regional corporations also came over 200 village corporations. Our regional corporations and our village corporations, all distinctly different corporations. The village corporations are not subsidiaries. Oftentimes people think of village corporation as a subsidiary of a regional corporation, but they all are private for-profit. And the act created these and called corporations, but very different than the word corporation that we know in kind of our Western business moniker, because in the act, it actually states that these corporations will provide for the shareholders economically, socially, and culturally. So very different than what a corporation that's being set up right now in the lower 48. Next slide. So again, just a boundary map that you saw earlier, creating the 12 land-based corporations. As Barbara mentioned, a few years after ANCSA was signed, the 13th regional corporation came, and they were provided funds. They were financially compensated, but they were not provided land. And so that company has, the 13th regional corporation has dissolved, but it was in Washington State because we did, and we still continue to have, a significant number of shareholders residing in the Pacific Northwest. It's also really fun fact to know the size of our regions is very different by land mass and our shareholder base. Traditionally, Sea Alaska was one of our larger regional corporations by a shareholder base of having upwards of 22,000 shareholders. Just in the last couple of years, the Chulister region has surpassed, and they are now the largest shareholder base with nearly 35,000 Alaska Native shareholders within the Chulister region. By land mass is also very different. Doyon in our interior has 12.5 million acres of land. That's larger than the country of France. So very significant landholder, and then down to some of our smaller regions. Next slide. So while that last slide showed the regions by the boundaries, this is a really good kind of visual. I'm a visual person. So this shows in the pink the actual Native-owned land. So as you can imagine, surrounded, much of Alaska Native-owned land is surrounded by our state lands and our federal lands. So for instance, managing those lands and accessing those lands sometimes presents an issue. in Otna region. Otna's on the road system, and they have some of the best hunting area in the state on the road system. So as you can imagine, they deal with significant trespass issues within their region. Next slide. Continuing on our theme about land ownership, Alaska is very unique in its structure that we have the most state and federally owned lands than any other state. But with our Alaska Native corporations owning 44 million acres of land, our Alaska Native corporations therefore own 92% of the private land in the state of Alaska. And that's a very important factor when we start talking about consultation. Barbara mentioned the importance of ensuring that our Alaska Native people are represented when we start to talk about consultation. When we start to talk about consultation on lands, impacts to our Native people, it's essential that our tribes and our Alaska Native corporations are at the table joining those conversations. Next slide. So the ANCSA Act also called us shareholders. It created corporations, and we were called shareholders. Again, probably not something that we recognize how that word would be viewed 50 years later after the Act, but we were given about 2 years to enroll people into our regional corporations. You rolled in where you resided or where your heritage and your family were from. 2 years after the Act, we had about 64 to 69 original shareholders. And you had to be one quarter Native blood quantum, born on or before December 18, 1971. And you received 100 shares of your regional corporation and your village corporation. And then the Act also gave us about 20 years to work out the kinks. So we have an amendment in the Act, next slide, called the 1991 Amendment. However, they were done probably in the early 80s. We still refer to them as the 1991 Amendment. And that extended the period of stock alienation, and it preserved that Alaska Native ownership. The Alaska Native regional and village corporations are controlled by Alaska Native people. The board of directors are elected Alaska Native shareholders. And these corporations are also very different from your normal corporation in that we have really diversified Alaska's economy. All of the Alaska Native corporations are headquartered in Alaska, doing business globally, and ensuring that those profits are coming back to the state of Alaska to support our shareholders, our descendants, and our communities, and employing Alaskans. And the land is so important to our Alaska Native people and to the Alaska Native corporations that if it's not developed, it's not carried on a balance sheet. Again, that is a very different structure from what any other corporation or individual might do. Now, Barbara also mentioned the 7I and 7J provisions, so I don't need to go into detail, but next slide. Those are 70% of the profits from natural resource wealth are shared among the regional corporations, and then they take a minimum of 50% of that and share it to the village corporations. So it is a complete economic sharing. Because when ANCSA was signed, we had a disparity of natural resource wealth. So our elders ensured that we were continued to take care of each other regardless of where we resided in the state. And if you look at a five-year average, we need to update those numbers, but well over $200 million a year goes to the regional corporations and the village corporations in that 7I revenue sharing. And for many of our smaller village corporations, that is the sustainability factor that really enables them to operate their corporations, to support their communities, and most importantly, providing scholarships and dividends and benefits for their shareholders. Next slide. So I just love this slide because it really, again, talks about what these corporations are doing. Every one of the regional corporations has an additional elder benefit. There is culture camps, language revitalization, scholarships, training activities, advocacy efforts, it really is a unique structure that we're so incredibly proud of. ANCSA isn't perfect, but it really has been a wonderful success factor for our Alaska Native people. Last slide. Nope, I think actually just a couple more. So this just is a real quick snapshot of kind of where we've come in the last 50 years. We started with about 64,000 to 69,000 original shareholders. We now have over 160,000 shareholders across the 12 regional corporations. We are not capturing descendants, but there are tens of thousands more descendants that we don't have in our numbers. Scholarships are the common, and education is the common thread that truly unites all of our regional corporations. Each one of the regional corporations does have an education foundation that focuses in on anywhere from ages 3 on up, ensuring that our younger generation is prepared and has every opportunity afforded to them that we could possibly make. So over 5,000 individual scholarships in 1 year alone. And then we have a few other data points. But our donations across the board, too, on a 5-year rolling average, donations to our nonprofits, well over $22 million a year. And then we talked about the regional corporations doing business across the globe, more than 16,000 employees across the state, but close to 60,000 across our globe. And last slide. So, our top 49er data that I think many of us Alaskans are familiar with, of the top performing 49 companies, privately owned companies in the state of Alaska, 25 of those are either our Alaska Native regional corporations or our Alaska Native village corporations, becoming a very strong economic model for our state. To date, since we've been capturing the data, more than $4 billion have been awarded in dividends. And if you're going to pack the biggest suitcase, I'm glad it's education. More than 58,000 individual scholarships, and now we're well over $120 million that have been awarded in post-secondary vocational training scholarships for our Alaska Native people. And I know you're on a time crunch, so last slide, Callan. Quiana, thank you so much for your time. I will let you know that we produced a very short 30-minute video celebrating 50 years of ANCSA, and our partners at Alaska Airlines have put it on the Alaska Airlines Entertainment. So the next time you find yourself on an Alaska Airlines flight, please check out what I say is a short 30-minute video, but my 15-year-old says it's a little bit long. So... welcome any questions that you might have. And again, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you very much for presenting, Ms. Wright-Meyer. I will have members of this committee know that it is required viewing that you watch that. I will have a quiz ready at a following committee, so please be sure to watch that. We'll have a lot of detailed questions. Does anyone have any questions on this presentation? None. Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thank you again, Ms. Wright-Meyer, for your presentation. Now, coming up, we have President Peterson of the Tlingit and Haida Indian tribe to give us some remarks. So whenever you're ready, thank you for coming.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you for this opportunity, Representative McCormick and members of the House Tribal Affairs Committee. Really appreciate this opportunity, and I have to take a personal note. At 19 years old, I was elected mayor in my village, and at 21, our village tribal president. And I spent a lot of time walking the halls of this building, talking to our representatives. And no kidding, when we mentioned tribes, it had to be done in whispers. And the fact that today that this committee exists shows that there is great progress in the relationships between our tribes and the state of Alaska. I'd like to start by acknowledging the Akwan and Takukwan and Saganukchish for allowing us to conduct our meetings on their traditional lands here in Tsongkahiti, also known as Juneau. My name is Chakyat Yish. You might know me as Richard Peterson, and I currently serve as the president of Central Council of Klinkenhai Indian Tribes of Alaska. A lot of what I wanted to say was covered by my sister Wathlal Gadok and Kim, so I want to thank them for their presentations. And I don't have a slideshow or presentation for you. I go pretty fast, so feel free to tell me to slow down, and I really do enjoy questions and answers so I hope you do have some questions for me. I'm probably going to say some things that may rub some folks wrong, and I hope I do, because that hopefully will stimulate some conversation, and I don't get offended by anything, so I welcome all questions. Klinkit Haida is the largest tribe in Alaska with over 35,000 enrolled tribal citizens across the state, the nation, and the world. Klinkit Haida is unique as it is a regional tribe representing Southeast communities. Klinkit Haida was formally recognized as a tribal government by an act of Congress in 1935, making us the oldest tribe. And this was done in order to pursue land claims on behalf of the Klinkit Haida people. We have our governing body is comprised of 116 tribal delegates elected by our 19 Southeast communities and Seattle and San Francisco. And many would ask why Seattle and San Francisco. That's because there were actual programs, and you may have heard of extermination efforts of the era, relocation programs, move us away to civilize us, to, you know, kill the Indian, save the man. And so when we were formed in 1935, there were large populations of our citizens in the Seattle and San Francisco areas, as that's where they were sent for education opportunities. I'll use opportunities. And so it really does make us very unique in the way that we operate. We currently have offices here in Juneau, Haines, Craig, Ketchikan, Sitka, Anchorage, and soon to be Seattle. We have over 500 employees, and I'll actually add a caveat to that. Like our ANCSA Corporation brothers and sisters, we also participate in government contracting, and so we have over 1,600 employees outside of our government side, in our contracting side, that are direct employees of Klinkit Haida and its subsidiaries that we own wholly. So, and we're very proud of that. We do government contracting, military bases. We support our country in many very important and needed ways. And it does return a healthy dividend back to us, in which we help provide services that otherwise are unmet. We have a new program that we established 2 years ago, Community Navigators. And we have a community navigator in each of our communities to serve as a point of contact for our citizens that to help them access resources and opportunities. So a lot of folks just don't know what it is that we offer, what they can do, scholarships and beyond. So these folks help people get enrolled, help them get IDs, help them find scholarships, assistance, and just access programs. So we're very pleased about that. As a sovereign entity, we have a government-to-government relationship with municipal, state, and federal governments. Compacting is a government-to-government agreement to administer programs, and as Wathlal Gadok did a very good job explaining that, or at least I found it very good. I hope that you did. We have our trust relationship is repeatedly upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm very direct and forgive. I said I'm going to offend some people. Our governor currently is suing the federal government over our land to trust application that was approved. And I'm saddened by this because the state of Alaska has done this before and also lost, and our rights continually are upheld. And I want to say that our sovereignty should not be feared. Our sovereignty is not in contrast to state sovereignty, as was explained in previous presentations. We happily coexist. Some of us find ourselves with multiple designations, citizenry. I'm a citizen of Alaska. I'm a citizen of Klinkit Haida. I'm a citizen of the United States. Recognition of tribes inherent authority to serve their citizens has long been upheld by the United States. And I'm both pleased and find it ironic that in the last legislative session, tribal recognition by the state of Alaska was passed and adopted. And on the first day of your session, basically our sovereignty was challenged and the federal government is being sued over our land of trust. So yay, recognizing us. So Clinkett and Haida executes federal compacts with the Bureau of Indian Affairs on behalf of several communities in Southeast, administrating sophisticated programs such as TANF, which also the state of Alaska gets TANF and then passes through another level of TANF to us. So we get it both directly from the BIA and then indirectly through the state of Alaska. We do employment and training, child care, natural resources, economic development, tribal court, public safety, broadband deployment, community behavioral services. So while we do compact with the federal government, we strive for economic sovereignty. With federal funding, we're bound by their regulations, oftentimes limiting our to service area and eligibility requirements. And you might recall I mentioned we have 35,000 citizens. Not all of them live here in the geographic area in which we receive funding for. So that's why we pursue government contracting and other means of earning money so that we call and enjoy our own economic sovereignty and can serve all of our citizens how we see fit. And so we think that's a direct act of sovereignty in and of itself. So as the president of Clinkett and Haida, I have a responsibility to serve all 35,000 tribal citizens, regardless of where they reside. Clinkett and Haida is the sole owner of Clinkett and Haida Tribal Business Corporation and CURA, which does government contracting around the world. This brings in the unrestricted funds that Clinkett and Haida uses to fill service gaps. One of the most fundamental ways that Clinkett and Haida exercises our sovereignty is also through our tribal courts. Clinkett and Haida first established its court in 2010. Today it includes most civil case types, including guardianship, adoption, paternity, child welfare, child custody, divorce, marriage, domestic violence protection proceedings, and child support. Clinkett and Haida adopts tribal law. We have 15 titles of statutory law, enrollment, wellness code, investment, audit, marriage, divorce, custody, and et cetera. Another act of our sovereignty has been buying our land back and putting it into trust status. At the direction of our tribal assembly, which is much like you serve in the legislature, that's our version of our legislature, we've been directed to buy back land in the Juneau Indian Village, and for over a decade we have had applications to put these lands into trust. The lands include parking lots and our tribal headquarters. We are legally and lawfully buying back land that was legally and unlawfully taken from our people. Our sole purpose for putting these lands into trust is to protect our traditional homelands into perpetuity. I want to stop there and focus on that because, as you can probably tell, I'm very frustrated about this lawsuit, a lawsuit that alleges many things. And I think it's fair to ask the question, but the governor states that they're asking the question that they feel ANCSA extinguished tribal rights. Well, ANCSA does not. And that question has been asked and answered actually in court previously, so we really want to see those decisions upheld. Again, our sovereignty does not contradict or cause conflict with the state of Alaska. As I said, this last year I thought was a monumentous year where we had the recognition by the state of Alaska, the 229 tribes in Alaska. We currently already compact with the state of Alaska for OCS services. We contract with the state of Alaska for public safety and run the VPSO program. And I do want to thank the legislature and our governor for last term really seeing the first increase in public safety in quite a long time. You know, and you'll hear me talk about one thing if you hear me speak is healthy tribes make healthy communities. And I think that's really something to be cognizant of, really be aware of. If you live in rural Alaska and have running water, you can flush your toilets, you probably 95% of which could thank a tribe. It's because of the tribes that that money makes its way to Alaska. Literally hundreds of millions of dollars a year find their way to Alaska because of our tribes. So you see running water, clinics, you're going to see broadband deployment because of tribes. And because of the lack of what they call Indian country, which land of trust would solve for us, we lose hundreds of millions of dollars more. Under the Obama administration, there was over $600 million that was available to tribes that was not available to Alaska tribes because of lack of Indian country. So this isn't a Democrat-Republican statement. That was just money that just was lost off the table because we didn't have land of trust. I've heard many rumors that we have nefarious goals for land of trust. If you know the process, the goals are stated in the application. I can't change those. I can't have a secret agenda. It is literally to put it, the land into trust, to hold so that it protects it and it remains in tribal hands into perpetuity. Now, Clinkett and Haida has been buying quite a bit of land here in Juneau, and some of it we will choose not to put into land of trust because actually having it in trust is cumbersome and creates a lot of difficulties. And if I do want to do something different, if I want to develop some land for housing and sell it, it would be a very difficult process under the Department of Interior. So there's many reasons not to put it into trust. I've heard that we're going to put a casino in downtown Juneau. We absolutely cannot do that. That would have to be a whole different process. And land of trust after 1988 is not allowed to put in for gaming. So I'm pretty sure the Department of Law knows these things. They're not secret. It's not a secret law for tribes. So when they say this and they're suing us, I find it very disingenuous. The other reason, and you have to realize the land of trust application that got approved is about the size of a driveway. Probably four cars could park on it. So it's the first, and the rest, if you've been to our building downtown, the parking lot and the land that the building is also applications to be approved. Those can only be used for what we stated in the application, which is maintaining our government services. So again, no nefarious things. Well, the governor asserts that the fear is the lost revenue for the municipality. Well, that also is disingenuous because we already don't pay taxes to the municipality. And in fact, we are nearly complete. CBJ has been quite wonderful to work with, and we have an intergovernmental agreement. And CBJ supports our applications. So when the state of Alaska says they're suing for these things, maybe they should have checked with CBJ. So I know I'm coming across a little harsh, but I'm definitely frustrated about this and think that, again, we believe healthy tribes make healthy communities, and that when we are doing our job, you know, I heard Wathlagadoc talk about it doesn't just benefit our community. Again, if you go to my village of Kasan, everybody in that community enjoys a clinic. Everybody in that community enjoys running water. Everybody enjoys a public school. All of those were funded with tribal dollars. So I want to just remind you again that AICSA did not extinguish tribal rights. And we're working, it's taken 50 years of AICSA, but I think our tribes and our corporations are learning to work very much better together and in a way that will uplift our communities. And when we uplift our communities, we uplift Alaska. So, Ganesh Hawa.
Thank you very much for your remarks, President Peterson. Do we have any questions? Representative Vance.
Thank you, through the chair. President Peterson, I apologize. I just briefly read about, this land trust. And if the land that you're talking about is just the size, roughly the size of a driveway, what's the benefit of going through all these steps to put it into the trust versus the status that you have now?
So, again, through the chair, Representative Anson, it's good to see you back again. Again, my point about the lack of Indian country in Alaska. So with that landed trust, we now have Indian country, and it makes us eligible for funding that we did not previously get. And also, it's only one of about 9 applications that we had in, because it was kind of a hodgepodge of the properties down here on Willoughby. So that was our first application and the easiest for them to get through. The other ones, because you have to go through environmental impact statements, you have to go through a lot to get these into trust. And so where our building is on Willoughby, the Anderhope building, and the parking lot were all applied for, but they were literally different lots.
Follow up. So I'm trying to wrap my brain around just the distinction. So this would be Indian country, much like the land with Metlakatla?
Well, it's not a reservation, but it would receive Indian country status, in that we would be able to be eligible for funding.
All right, thank you.
Representative Ballard, did you raise your hand? No. But does anyone else have any further questions? None? Gee whiz, guys. Okay. All right, well, thank you very much, President Peterson, for your remarks. If you have any closing comments, please, by all means.
I really do just want to thank you all. I think every one of you who run for public office, it can be a thankless job, but I appreciate that you're both here in that role and in this, keeping this committee going. I also, Clinkin Haida is a very sophisticated tribe. We run very sophisticated programs, very complicated. Head Start, for example, is probably one of the most overregulated programs I've ever seen in my life. And to me, that should be about the simplest anytime we just want to help our children, serve our children. But I would offer an invitation to any of you to reach out to my staff, and we would love to take you on a tour here in Juneau to see some of our operations. We have a behavioral health department that's doing marvelous things. We're doing economic development. I hope you partake in Sacred Grounds and some of our other businesses here in Juneau. But I would also challenge you, wherever you live in the state of Alaska, there's 229 tribes. Reach out to your tribe and learn from them. I work very closely with folks like Tanana Chiefs and Koyaik and AVCP, and they are doing equally amazing things in and for Alaska. So, Kanichishawa.
Thank you very much again. So I understand we have to be on the floor at 5, so I think we're going to go ahead and conclude here for this afternoon. Our next meeting is Wednesday, March 8th. We will be hearing House Bill 26, an act renaming the Alaska Native Language Preservation Advisory Council as the Council for Alaska Native Languages and relating to the Council for Alaska Native Languages. And then also, I think at that meeting, I'll afford everyone the opportunity to kind of introduce themselves, where they're coming from, all of that. Kweana, to everyone who came and presented today, I think we got a lot of great information. I just want to say that we'll continue to have a number of other informational hearings so that we're all kind of aware of the relationship that the state of Alaska has with tribes and the services that they provide. The time is 4:30 p.m., and this hearing of the House Tribal Affairs Committee is now adjourned.